Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
So among the scientific stories you hear about, if you're listening to this program or others, is the rapid developments that are taking place in brain science, both in the nature and diagnosis of mental illness. Diagnostic tools exist to do things that we would have never thought possible even as recently as 10 years ago. And that means that more and more people are coming in for evaluations for mental illnesses who might never have been before, particularly young children. Bipolar disorder is a very hard syndrome to treat in an adult, but what happens when the diagnosis is for a 4-year-old or a 3-year-old who gets diagnosed with it? And what does an early diagnosis mean? Is it a lifetime battling the disease? What are the consequences for parents and children who grow up with a diagnosis of bipolar disorder? In, an amazing article in this Sunday's New York Times Magazine, writer Jennifer Egan visits with families who are having this experience to see what a little information and how it can be a very dangerous thing in the development of a child and the nature of parenthood. Jennifer Egan, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
You spent a lot of time with families who have had this diagnosis, and I'm wondering if you could tell anything about the experience of the parents who, first of all, decided to actually even get their children tested, and then how they live with the diagnosis and the medication and the complicated therapies that are the consequence of such a diagnosis.
Well, the first thing I would say is that there's among the families I spent time with, and there were many. The kids are really not all alike, which does speak to the question of whether these kids ultimately will end up being called bipolar. But one thing that they really do all have in common is that they have severe problems. Most of them are unable to function in a normal school, and a significant portion of them express their mental illness in the form of a very explosive and oppositional kind of anger. So it's a huge challenge for the families, and I think that in a way, the most poignant thing was to see that in families that have more than one child, the way that this worked among siblings, especially if the impaired child was the older one, there really was a lot of what I would call abuse toward the younger sibling, which was impossible for the parents to completely control and incredibly painful and really agonizing to see.
Certainly, parents who grow up with children with maybe more traditional illnesses or even sort of episodic health problems are taught to kind of take a detached approach, let the medicine work, make sure the child is compliant with the therapy, and then they'll get better on their own. But in a mental illness case, the parents have to be much more intervening in the daily sort of affairs of the child. I'm wondering if parents have the expertise to deal with the kinds of circumstances that you talk about in your article.
It's interesting that you say that. I mean, a lot of parents say that they feel like they are essentially the healthcare professionals because not only do they have to dispense the medication and deal with the children on a day-to-day basis, but their description of the child's activities and moods is largely what determines the diagnosis, believe it or not. Because you can't just, you know, insurance tends to pay for about an hour or an hour and a half of evaluation. Anyone with a child knows if you bring the child to a doctor, generally the child becomes asymptomatic at the moment of walking in the door.
And yeah, I've noticed that.
That can be true of mentally ill children, too. So you can't expect them to manifest the behavior in that amount of time. So parental report is a huge part of the diagnosis. And yes, it's a huge challenge. I mean, especially when the behavior in question is behavior that involves a risk or a threat to the child, him or herself, or other kids. I mean, I talked to many parents whose kids had seriously hurt other children, you know, thrown a pool ball at someone, bitten through someone's clothing. So it's a huge responsibility. And what I found, it was surprising to me how calm and really impressive a lot of the parents were having come through some of this. But in other cases, I was working with some families who ended up feeling that they were ill-equipped to handle the behavior ultimately and decided to send their children away for residential schooling. And that's obviously a huge decision and
course.
A wrenching one.
Yeah. You know, normally in a story like this, we would begin with some alarming statistics on the rise of this or that diagnosis or this or that therapy. And I deliberately didn't do that on this time because In your article, you really describe how difficult it is even to sort out the statistics in this story. Describe what it is that you found.
Well, one thing my editor kept saying was, how many children are bipolar, have this diagnosis in America? We need that number. In fact, there really is no such number right now. I mean, there was an alarming study that came out last fall announcing that there had been a 40-fold increase in the number of pediatric bipolar diagnoses. And I think, in a way, a lot of the alarming articles ran then. But it's hard to know what to make of that statistic. It measures the number of time children go to the doctor. It doesn't measure the number of children with a diagnosis. And before at the time that the study began, there were essentially zero children being diagnosed with this. So it's really hard to say. I mean, anecdotally, what I would say is that most of the professionals, most of the leaders in the field that I talk to, even those who are strong advocates for diagnosing this freely, who believe it's common, still felt it was being overdiagnosed and misdiagnosed. It seems like it has a little bit become the diagnosis of default if a child, say, is hospitalized and has mood problems. They will often walk out with a bipolar diagnosis. But what most clinicians say is, look, we don't understand the diagnosis yet, and everyone kind of agrees on that. But we need to watch these kids grow up and see what's actually wrong with them, but we can treat the symptoms. So I think that's what the clinicians end up having to do, and it's imperfect. I mean, everyone would like to know exactly what's going on, but that right now that is not entirely possible.
Well, in fact, what you're describing is a kind of a giant longitudinal experiment in families who have this disorder. Or trying to figure out what are the consequences as the kids grow up, and that's not going to be known until they do grow up, and perhaps that data will benefit families, you know, in the next generation. Your article, and you spent 7 months researching it, which is impressive in and of itself, comes at a time when there are really exciting developments in brain research. What is the sense, quickly before we go, of the development of biological markers or tests for parents to know early on what it is they're facing?
There is a sense that that will solve a lot of our problems. I mean, and in fact, take a lot of the stigma off of mental illness, because a lot of that is about the fact that we can't see it, we can't measure it, we can interpret it, but we can't name it in the way we can cancer and other things. So the hope is that by developing these markers, we'll be able to say to someone, you are at risk for this. Take precautionary steps so that hopefully they won't get it at all. And if they do, know exactly what the appropriate or better, what the appropriate protocol will be. I think there's a lot of hope placed on finding those markers.
Jennifer Egan, thank you very much for joining us.
It was a pleasure. Thanks.
And Jennifer Egan is a novelist and a writer, and her New York Times Magazine article on bipolar disorder diagnosis in families of young children appears in this Sunday's New York Times. And there are lots of ways to catch up with us on The Takeaway. You can find us on Twitter, Friend Feed, and Facebook. We're talking about super colliders. With your apocalyptic hat on, what are you going to do if the world ends tomorrow?
Hi, my name is Pat Rye. I'm calling from Bernardsville, New Jersey. Were the world to end tomorrow, today I would make sure I went to Mass, I'd have a great meal, lots of sex with my husband, and I would return all my library books.
In that order. Interesting. And here's your takeaway.
A man's wife phoned him here and said the dog is now barking at the ground in a very unusual way. And he did say, well, the tunnel goes right under my house.
BBC science correspondent Tom Fielden at the Center for Nuclear Research talking about the Large Hadron Collider, which is underneath the border between Switzerland and France. By the way, if you want to vote early before the world ends but are having trouble picking your U.S. presidential candidate before you get to the booth, we've got help at The Takeaway, the tool on Facebook, Who Should I Vote For? You enter three qualities, other Facebook users will tell you who to vote for. Politics is easy at The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. This is The Takeaway.